REI Co-op presents a mini mindfulness break. Take a deep breath in. Picture yourself on a mountain. As you hold your breath, look down at your skis, freshly waxed thanks to your REI membership, carving through powder like a knife to warm butter. Breathe out slowly. Let the air leave your lungs like you'd leave your local co-op with all the gear, clothing, classes, and advice you could hope for. Make time to opt outside. REI.com.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority. But to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. Obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution helping startups get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. The platform connects you with trusted experts to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including Y Combinator and Techstars startups who trust Vanta. For a limited time, get $1,000 off Vanta at vanta.com/simplify. That's VANTA.com/simplify for $1,000 off.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This is our second edition of the week, and well done to Judd Trump for winning the UK Championship for a second time. That was, of course, the tournament last week. A lot of drama in York. It ended with Trump winning his second UK title. He becomes the 10th player to be a multiple UK champion. It's not that many, because there's been, 48 stagings of that tournament. And, of course, he's also halfway to the Grand Slam. It was announced at the start of the season that the new Saudi Arabia Masters, it was announced by World Snooker Tour, by the way, who run the tour, it was announced that that has been granted major status. Judd Trump won that. He's won the UK Championship, which is the second major of the season. The third is the Masters, the fourth the World Championship. So it's halfway to the Grand Slam, which, as we know, is a long, standing historic achievement that's never been mentioned before, but I'm mentioning it now. Because that would be something, wouldn't it, if he won all four. If he won all four, trying to work out the finances there. It's $1 million for the Saudi and World combined. This was 250. It's 350 for the Masters. So it'd be 1.6 million if he won all four. That would be unique, obviously. But anyway, we'll see where we go with that. But well done to Judd Trump. It was a very dramatic final against Barry Hawkins, who I thought played really well. Not least because, of course, he'd had that marathon against Mark Allen, which we will come to. I've had some correspondence about that. One in the morning, 6 hours from gun to tape. You know, he had every right to be tired. He didn't show any of that. He played well. He put it to Trump in the final session. Couldn't get level. That was the problem. He couldn't get on level terms. He got within one a couple of times, but Trump always held him off because he nearly went 9-all. Barry needed two snookers, got one, laid a load more. Just couldn't quite get that deciding frame, you know, in the bag would make it 9-all. But, excuse me, I thought Trump overall played very well in the week. I think sometimes when people assess him, they kind of, maybe it's not that they don't notice he's playing well, that's not the right way of putting it, but I think his game has changed to such an extent that when we used to rave about Trump, it was often the long potting, the kind of, the Hollywood shots really, the flair stuff. That's how we used to measure his game. Now he's become such a great all-round player. He's become so adept at closing down frames, at controlling frames. And maybe he's not applauded or maybe lauded enough for that. So, you know, there were times during the week where he kind of wasn't doing the sort of flair stuff. He wasn't doing the more eye-catching stuff, but he was still doing a job. He started poorly against Neil Robertson. Well, the match started poorly. He was a poor first four frames. He was 3-1 down. But he did start to play well after that. Same with John Higgins. That started very poorly. But Trump, you know, it's not true to say broke free. He won in the decider. But, you know, he started to play better, as did John. And Trump played a good decider when Higgins left in that red to middle. Against Shanghanda, he was sensational. You know, 527 points without reply. I was hoping the points record would go. Nothing against Ronnie O'Sullivan or Stuart Bingham, Ronnie holds the all-time record, Bingham, in a ranking event. But, you know, it would just be nice to commentate on it. But he just fell short. But that was incredible. Four centuries in that match with Zhang Ander. Kyron Wilson, again, he started slowly against, but turned that round. And then in the final, I thought he played very well all day. So overall, I thought he was the deserving winner of the tournament. And, you know, well, he won the tournament. He is the deserving winner. But I thought his performance level overall, obviously in a long tournament like that, it's going to ebb and flow. And you don't have to always start, you know, with your best stuff. But overall, as I say, the way he wins has changed. And I think that's why he wins. And the fact is, as well, he made 11 century breaks, right? Now, the record in the UK Championship is 13. Neil Robertson and Ding Junhui both made 13. But that was in the time when it was a flat draw. So you actually came in the last 1-2-8. So they played two extra matches. In effect, 12 frames where they could have made centuries. Trump made 11 centuries in just five rounds. That is good going in a high-pressure tournament. And, you know, it's 13 years since he last won it. But, of course, he'd lost in two deciders since. But I thought he was the deserving winner, and I congratulate him. He has pulled out the Scottish Open, which is not a great surprise. You know, it's not like he hasn't played a lot of snooker. Maybe just can't try and sort of stay fresh going into the new year. The complication is, I mean, Trump's always supported all the events, and he's trying to win all the events. But I think if he's still living in Britain, he might have played in it. But, of course, he's based in Hong Kong now, so I guess he's gone back there to see his girlfriend. He'll be in Saudi, I'm sure, before Christmas. That's a big payday for, you know, 3 days' work. And then I'm sure we'll see him again at the Masters. He might play a bit of Championship League before that to try and tune up. But anyway, he can reflect on a very successful year, clearly. We turn, as so often before, to Alpha Bonzi, who's going to open up the questioning on the emails. He says, Alpha says, after a strange but compelling week in York, there was a lot of strangely underwhelming matches among the centuries and maximums. My three quick ones are, number one, there was a lot of talk about playing conditions and the tables. Knowing nothing about how outside conditions affect tables, what are the ideal conditions for championship tables, both inside and outside the auditorium? We'll do these one by one. I mean, from a player's perspective, obviously they want the best conditions that they can. So they want the tables to be level, first of all. And that sounds quite flippant, but actually it's an issue with some of these venues, you know, getting the tables level. It's not as straightforward as maybe it could be. So, you know, there were times when the tables seemed to roll off a little bit. So they want the tables level. They want the cloth to be reactive. They want the cushions not to be too springy, but equally not to be too soft, so that the balls don't bounce off them. And they want the pockets to be not buckets, but equally not brutally tough, but, you know, somewhere in between. And I think overall, I mean, they were on the tight side, but I think when it was recovered, I mean, I thought playing conditions early on were difficult. And I thought late on they were difficult. But I think in the middle of the week, after the first recover, the tables played really well. And that's when we saw all the centuries. We didn't see many at the start. We started to see more and more. There were 45 in total. So over 9 days, obviously, that's an average of 5 a day. Last year, there was 63. So that's an average of 7 a day. So it was down. But, you know, we had the maximum. And play in the middle of the week, I thought, was really good. So they want as good a conditions as possible. Now, you're quite right, talking about the outside. The weather can affect conditions, whether it's kind of cold out, wet out, if it's humid. All these things are challenges for the table fitters. And, you know, those guys, we've got an email about them later, they work very hard. So, you know, they're trying to get it as good as they can. Number two, could World Snooker have done more to address the numerous concerns brought up by the players over the tables? I'll answer that shortly, because we've got another email about that in a minute. Number three, what does a 13-year gap between Judd Trump's UK titles tell us about how hard it is to lift that huge silver trophy? Well, of course, he himself said afterwards, you know, he said, when players say, oh, I'm planning to peak for the majors, he says, you can't do that. You can't plan when to play well. And he also made the point, this was in the Eurosport studio afterwards, it was a good chat, as it always is when the players won, because the pressure's off and they can just be very candid. And he was making the point about, you know, people sort of separate out these sort of so-called majors with the other tournaments. But as he pointed out, it's the same players in the other tournaments. You played the same people. It's the same game. And it's just as hard to win those other events. There's just not as much scrutiny. And therefore, I guess what comes with something like the UK Championship is the extra pressure. In the UK, the fact it's on the BBC definitely lifts it as a media event, because it brings in other media. They kind of recognise it's on just because it's on the BBC. There's still that huge pulling power. So there's definite huge attention on it because of that. But it's hard to win. As I say, it's been two finals, lost in deciders both times. It was kind of you always felt he'd probably win it again and may well win it several times in the future. I guess for him now, the next one is the World Championship. It will be 6 years when he goes to the Crucible, you know, this season. He would love to become a multiple world champion, obviously. Alpha also asks here, a quick hand for Tatiana Woolaston and her handling of the final. Can you imagine them planning to give her the world final? And that's the year Ben goes all the way. Thanks for the podcast. It's the only reason to wake up on a Monday morning. Well, I hope that's not the only reason, Alpha, but anyway, thank you. Yeah, I mean, listen, if Tatiana was scheduled to do the world final, and I'm sure she will be in the next couple of years, and Ben then got to the final, she would be delighted, obviously, not to referee. She'd be made up for Ben. That's obvious. But hopefully we'll see at least one of them in a world final soon. But we had mentioned there of the table situation, and we had an email here from Rhys, who says, I'm usually just a listener of the podcast, and have written in a few times, but I've just seen something that made me compelled to rant. After Karen Wilson lost to Judd Trump, he went on to say something along the lines of, I don't like to drop anyone in it, but for me, you've got to be looking at the table fitters. The table's been really, really poor all week. I'm sorry, but this is the reason why Karen probably struggles to gain fans. His brother goes on the Talking Snooker podcast to boast about how Karen is the complete package, and there's not much more he can do to become a likeable character in the game, even alongside being world champion. And yet here he is moaning about a table after losing when Trump clearly didn't struggle. He just comes across as so arrogant, and the same with the whole I'm not on table one situation. I wanted to vent my frustration to you because to blame the table fitters is just really bad taste in my opinion. You're world champion, start acting like one. Well, trenchant words there from Rhys. There's a couple of things to say here. The first is, I'll say this, right? I don't mind bad losers. I don't mind someone losing and being in a bad mood. Why should they be in a good mood? What's good about coming off and sort of mouthing platitudes? Karen hates losing, and that's really why he is a kind of got that winner's mindset. You know, if you spoke to Stephen Hendry when he lost, I'm not saying he would have blamed the tables, but Stephen gave you nothing. I mean, he was always gutted and really distraught to lose. And clearly, Karen's been interviewed there in the corridor, you know, literally 5 minutes after he's lost. And I'm sure he was genuine in his feelings that the conditions weren't great, but also he was just disappointed to lose. And, you know, that is understandable. However, I was very interested in the response from World Snooker Tour to what Karen said. So obviously the press asked them for a response, and this is what they said. They said, our table-fitting team worked to the high standards, often through the night, to ensure the best possible playing conditions. However, they can only respond to the issues which get reported by players. Only two condition report sheets have been submitted this week. We always welcome feedback from players and encourage them to engage with us to make sure that table conditions are as good as they can be. So these are sheets that basically, when you finish a match, if you've got any issues with playing conditions, you can write them down. They get passed on to the tournament office and the table fitters, and they assess them. And they actually report back. And I know this because I was forwarded one from a previous tournament. So the players get this after the tournament. Each tournament, they get sent a breakdown of the issues that have been raised and what they've done to, you know, solve the issues. So I was sent one, for example, from the Northern Ireland Open, and it says that there were six report sheets filled in on various things, and they go through each one, and it says here, the reason for this email is to try and improve conditions for our events. We can only achieve this if we receive feedback on the conditions. We must receive more feedback, including where conditions do not meet your expectations and when they are good. By analysing these condition reports, we will have a better understanding of when conditions start to deteriorate, and this could help inform our event planning in the future. Now, to me, that's all very reasonable. They're trying there. They're saying there, look, we want to hear from you, so fill in these reports, let us know, and we can look at them and look to see if we can improve the conditions. And by the way, we'll get back to you and let you know what we've done. But, and this was, so this quote that came out from York was on the Saturday of the semi-final. They said the whole week they'd been there, they only had two reports submitted by players about conditions. So if the players don't actually take part in the process, how are they supposed to fix the problem? I mean, obviously, there are some issues that you can see. If a table's rolling off, it's pretty clear to the naked eye. If a cushion's bouncing, it's pretty clear to the naked eye. You don't need a player to tell you. However, if players are not happy, there is a system there, a process there they can follow. And I kind of understand WST's, you know, slight annoyance that players are going on TV saying it, but not actually getting down into the nitty-gritty of explaining to them, the organisers, what the problem is. Now, the players might say, well, actually, it's more effective going on TV doing it because you have a platform there and people can see it. But this is a little to me like, you know, for years, various political problems and people complaining about things. And whenever a players' meeting was called, four people would turn up. You know, there'd be all this sort of aggro and, oh, things aren't right. OK, well, we'll come to a room then and we'll discuss it. And four people turn up. You know, apathy is a killer, right? And players have got this quite straightforward process now where they can fill in a sheet, put forward their concerns, and they will hear back directly after the tournament about what's been done. You've got to take part in that, I think. And maybe Karen Wilson, after his match, did fill one in. I don't know. But the opportunity is there to engage with the people who... Look, everyone's trying to make the conditions good. That's the thing. But going back to the original point, I actually don't mind someone being a bad loser because I think, you know, it shows you that they care, I guess. Now, the match on... the semi-final on Saturday night between Mark Allen and Barry Hawkins drew a lot of sort of comment around the tournament, and we hear from Patrick, who says, I can't believe how slow the play is in this year's UK Championship. It's getting ridiculous. Allen v Hawkins Saturday night session. I don't like watching either of these players, so watch the Graham Norton show and the Wheel on iPlayer. Remember, they started at 7 p.m. and it's only 2-2 at 10 p.m. Neil Robertson used to be fast, but he is so slow. It's like watching paint dry. Something needs to be said to these players. My girlfriend says a minute's limit on each shot. I've also noticed that players who slow down are not as good. Well, I hope you enjoyed, Patrick, the Graham Norton show and indeed the Wheel. It was slow, or certainly Mark Allen. I mean, a lot of people have sort of commented on him and his pace of play. We've got other stuff on this. We've got Parser, who says, thanks for the podcast, as always, just watching the semi-final between Allen and Hawkins. While I do agree that a late-night decider drama is intriguing for hardcore fans, you've got to admit, the way Mark Allen plays is just bad for the game. He played so many negative shots in the decider, refusing reasonably challenging long pots. Don't even get me started on the penultimate red. And this is not the first time. We all remember his snooze fest with Selby in the World Championship semis. I understand the competitor Mark is, and fair play to him for doing whatever it takes to win. But I find it ridiculous that people like him complain about WST not promoting him or giving him the limelight. I mean, seriously, what's there to promote? Sorry for the rant. Thank God for your podcast, where us snooker fans can air our grievances. Keep up the great work. Well, it seems a week for ranting, but, yeah, I mean, look, there is no... I mean, Patrick, a moment ago, Patrick who wrote in, who'd watched the Graham Norton show on the Wheel instead of the snooker... said his girlfriend suggested a minute's shot clock. I mean, people have talked about shot clocks before. Some people have said 30 seconds. I think Neil Robertson suggested 35. That's been talked about, and of course it will be in the shootout this week. But in terms of the pace of play, the referee, of course, does have the option to step in if they think a player's taking too long. And it did happen at the qualifiers. It happened to an unlikely player, actually, young Stan Moody. In his, I think, in his second match there, the referee sort of basically told him to hurry up, in effect. And he won that match. He played a lot quicker in his last match, albeit didn't win it. But it kind of maybe it was a good thing for him to hear that. I don't know. In the rules, it's not slow play. It's time wasting. So if a referee feels a player's taking a long time, and of course it depends what shot you're playing. If you're snookered, you know, tight in behind the brown, wedged onto the bulk cushion, you're going to take a bit of time trying to work out how to get out of it. If you've got a black off the spot, there's no reason to take a minute thinking about it. So context is everything. And you do see referees, you know, using their discretion sometimes to have a word. You don't always necessarily know it's happened because they don't always do it in the arena. So that option is there. Now, this was a major semi-final of a big tournament. So maybe the thinking was, well, you know, it's not for the referee to necessarily step in that environment because it's such a big match and it means a lot. I don't know. Mark Allen, I think I would say this about him. He's obviously had a very successful couple of years, not won a title this season. It seems he's kind of searching for something in his game. Now, he's joined up with Lee Walker, who is becoming a very well-respected coach. Lee, by the way, was not the quickest player, it's got to be said. I don't think he would deny that. But, you know, he's working with him. And I get the feeling, personally, and I've commentated on the whole match, I get the feeling that the pace of play, it, to a large degree, was Mark Allen kind of trying to think about what he'd been maybe discussing with Lee. And maybe there was a slight lack of confidence there as well. But we'll get on, because this kind of accelerated a bit because Sean Murphy was commentating. And if I can find the email, and people will say, well, why didn't you do this before you started recording? But if I can find the email, I will discuss what was said there because it's quite interesting. Yes, it's Callum Law, actually. Hello, Callum. So I hope you well enjoyed the Yukachevership. Indeed, I did. He said, I thoroughly enjoyed watching the 9 days of action with Judd Trump, an impressive winner. Trump's resolve and ability to find a way to win when he isn't playing well is particularly impressive. When Barry Hawkins got back to 7-6, there was a huge difference between how the two of them were playing, but Trump found a way to wrestle back momentum and win the title. It's hard not to feel sorry for Barry. He's an excellent player, but in the biggest tournaments, he's always come up slightly short. Aside from that, there are a few things I wondered if you had an opinion on. Okay, so this is, we'll get to the Sean Murphy thing in a minute, but he says, is Jack Lazowski the most overrated player in snooker? That may sound a bit derogatory towards Jack, but when I look at his ability and his output in terms of tournament wins, I can't think of anyone with a similar amount of talent who's failed to win things. Well, I think the thing with Jack, he played very well against Selby, he played well against Ali Carter, he played well at the start against Mark Allen, and then it kind of fell apart. I think when he wins, because he is so eye-catching and such a sort of beautiful player, natural player to watch, I think there's always a slight overreaction. It's not that he's sort of overrated. It's a bit of an overreaction to maybe how he plays. But that's just people who love watching snooker. So I've got no problem with that, and I've been part of that myself. The problem is Jack doesn't play like that all the time, and when he doesn't play like that all the time, you know, he gets beat. So it seems that his issue really is if he doesn't find his A game, he isn't winning. Whereas there are certain players, and actually Judd Trump is one himself, who've got B and C games they can win with because they're so good. Callum continues, on a totally different note, have Sean Murphy and Mark Allen actually fallen out, or is this public spat just banter? I thought Sean and Mark were good pals, and while I find their back and forth comments about each other amusing, it would be a shame if they'd fallen out. I don't know is the answer. I mean, Sean has his own podcast. I'm sure he'll be the 147 with Phil Seymour. I'm sure he'll be discussing that when they return, I think, this week. It doesn't sound like banter to me, I've got to be honest. It seems to have gone beyond that. I didn't hear Sean's commentary because I was commentating myself. I've only read sort of bits of what he said. He questioned, or he kind of suggested that it could be questioned whether Mark Allen was slowing the match down deliberately. Now, I commentated with Dominic Dale, who said a similar thing in a slightly different way. He sort of went through the possibilities of why the pace of play was so slow, and that was one of the things he raised. He wasn't pointing the finger necessarily, but he just said, you know, it's been known that has been a tactic from certain players. So I don't know. Mark Allen obviously responded on X. I mean, he wouldn't have heard the commentary either because he was playing in the match, but he's obviously, people have told him what Sean has said, and he wasn't very happy about it. which is interesting because Allen himself did some commentary, and also, I mean, he said many times, because he's been quite outspoken about various things, Mark Allen, over the years, and he said many times, he said, I know people don't always like what I say, but I'm always honest. Well, that's what Sean Murphy was being on the commentary. It was the same thing. And you might not like what he said, but he's there to give his view as a commentator, and that's what he did. By the way, there's a difference between being honest and being right, but that's a separate issue. So I don't know whether they've fallen out or not, but maybe Sean can let us know. It'd be a shame in a way, but then again, I always think, why have they got to be friends anyway? Why should two members of the world's top 10 be great pals? You're supposed to be rivals. So, you know, I don't see it actually as a big issue, really. I know one thing, next time they play, it'll be built up quite rightly as a bit of a grudge match. And we could do with a few, actually, in the game, to be honest. Callum continues, was it poor that the BBC in their first event since the death of Clive Everton didn't broadcast some kind of tribute to Clive in one of the intervals given his length of service to the BBC? However, please feel free to correct me if they did broadcast something, which I missed. I'm happy to say they did on the first afternoon, Callum. It was very nicely narrated by Hazel Irvin, as you would expect. and at the same time pay tribute to Ray Reardon. So they did a nice tribute, I'm pleased to say. We'll come back to you, talk about Terry Griffiths. I'm going to talk about Terry again later, so I'll come back to that, if that's okay. We'll continue with the UK Championship. Jake Warwick, he says, I hope you enjoyed this week as much as I have, and always, as always, thank you for your hard work in the box and on the podcast. It doesn't go unnoticed. Well, thank you, Jake. He says, I'm writing this after the conclusion of the UK final, where Judd Trump's lucrative season continues. It's incredible when you look back at the calibre of players he's had to beat. Robertson, Higgins, Yang, Kyron, and finally Barry. There couldn't have been a much more difficult route to the title. As has been said across all the coverage, Judd's ability to adapt and play every type of frame to get him through is an incredible asset. He can play lights out snooker like in the four frames against Shanganda, or scrap it out and play incredible safety like against Robertson and Higgins. Yeah, you put your finger there, Jake, on what I was saying earlier. I think some of the sort of comment around Trump's game is that he's only playing well when he's playing lights out snooker. I would argue that a lot of the other stuff, the all-round stuff, is just as impressive because he's still winning. You can't argue with that. He's still winning, and he's just winning in a different way. Anyway, Jake continues. I hope, if only for a few moments, this silences the he doesn't win triple crown titles, people. Any tournament is very difficult to win, never mind the so-called triple crowns. Having just watched his title-winning interview in the Eurosport studio, it's so refreshing to hear Judd say he gives each tournament the same attention, and every tournament has the same players in, so are equally tough to win. There's echoes of Hendry's winning era, where because he was so relentless, both of them winning all the time could be considered boring, and everyone rooted for the underdog. I laughed at Judd's comment saying that Barry had the whole crowd on his side, and the only people wanting Judd to win were his family. Barry played great all week and beat some true greats of the game. He's a true gentleman and a credit to the sport. I can't help feeling that, if anything, he's too nice. He got all the support, but it's the feeling of always being the bridesmaid, never the bride. I feel, along with Lazowski, the whole snooker community would love it if Barry went on to win a major title, along with his multiple other ranking event victories. In no way is this any shade on Barry, as he's one of the best match players around, if such a thing exists. Just a couple of points to finish off this already too long of an email. What a moment for Zhang Ander making an incredible maximum break and then nonchalantly putting his hand up to the crowd and walking straight out like it's an everyday occurrence. I must admit, I did like that. I thought that was terrific. He's quite an understated character, Zhang Ander, and I like the way he did that. He said, also, how nice was it to have Holtie back in the tournament? He enjoyed a good run and produced some real entertainment. However, by the look on Jack Jones's face, I don't think he was that entertained. Michael comes across as very endearing and someone the crowd can really get behind, as well as being a top snooker player. Congratulations again to Judd Trump, and I can't wait for the Masters in January, where I have tickets to the tie of the round on the opening Sunday, Ronnie O'Sullivan versus John Higgins. It should be a cracker. Yeah, well, thank you, Jake. And yes, I mean, that is some way to launch the tournament, isn't it? Excuse me. Yeah, Barry Hawkins, I mean, is he too nice? I don't know about that. I mean, Barry's a terrific player, and he is a really nice guy, but you know, people's personalities obviously are all different, but a lot of players manage to lay all that aside when they go into the arena and they just become sportsmen. And you know, he hasn't won one of these triple crown tournaments, but if you look at, he's been in four finals, and these are the people he's played, okay? Ronnie O'Sullivan twice, Neil Robertson and Judd Trump. So he's come up against great, great players in those finals. It's not like any of those finals he absolutely should have won. He did get crowd support. There's a bit of kind of underdog support there that is a British thing. You don't get that in every country. In a lot of countries, they want the kind of, you know, the serial winner to keep winning. In Britain, we've always had this sort of rooting for the underdog, and you know, I'm sure there's university theses written about why. In terms of Judd Trump and the Triple Crown and all that, I mean, listen, I feel I've said far too much about this whole issue, and my view on it hasn't changed, and neither has nobody else's, by the way. I accept that it is something that, you know, people talk about, and my word, they talked about it last week. But it was interesting, actually. Obviously, Terry passed away, Terry Griffiths. The obituary of Terry in The Guardian had been written by Clive before he himself passed away. So he'd written it, you know, well, I imagine a couple of years ago, and they sort of update them, you know, when if they need to. But anyway, Clive wrote this obituary, and in one line, he basically explains the whole Triple Crown thing really well. So he's talking about Terry's career, and he says here, in 1982... Griffiths completed the third leg of what is now known as Snooker's Triple Crown, the World, UK and Masters titles. So, as ever, Clive, in one line there, has summed it all up. It's now known as it wasn't then. Without wishing to drag Terry into this whole thing, when he won the 82 UK, he'd already won the other two, nobody said to him, oh, well done, you're a Triple Crown winner. This is a much more modern concept, but it is a concept that clearly is being pushed, and that's okay, that's fine, do that. The objection I have is the idea that it's this historical thing when it isn't. But, you know, it seems an increasingly small point. I think people who want to use it as a stick to beat Trump are increasingly looking absurd, actually. Judd Trump is winning lots of different tournaments. As I mentioned, Saudi was a massive event. Just the pressure on him with the money there and just the idea of trying to clear up and win a major final. And also, all right, the last thing, I mean, I know I've said this before, but the last thing on the Triple Crown thing, it was said that he's level with Alex Higgins now, 5 Triple Crown titles. Well, one of the ones Alex won was the 1972 World Championship, right? The other two tournaments did not exist then. So are people seriously saying that when Alex won that, someone went up to him and said, well done, Alex, you've won a Triple Crown title. By the way, we'll invent the other two tournaments in a few years. On that basis, Joe Davis has won 15 of them. So the circuit has changed massively, and there's a lot of big tournaments now around the world, which is great, and hopefully there'll be many more, you know, added in the years to come. And Judd Trump does not discriminate, he just wins them. He wins tournaments in China, he wins tournaments in the UK, he wins tournaments, and that should be celebrated. And it's increasingly odd to point the finger at him because he doesn't win enough tournaments on the BBC, which is all this is really about ultimately. What he's doing is phenomenal, and he should be applauded, and he should be congratulated for what he's doing. And by the way, he's just won the UK Championship. Anyway, we'll continue. Steve Hooley says, I watched most of the UK Championship final between Judd and Barry. So Steve wasn't tempted to watch the Graham Norton show or the wheel, which is good. You know, he saw most of the final. He says, I saw Barry succumb to Judd 10-8 and then be immediately interviewed live on national television. I have to say, what a fantastic bloke Barry is. What courage and humility he has. He came across so well, including congratulating Judd on his victory. I hope all the professional players are watching, as there are some players that could learn something on how you should conduct yourself in that situation. I hope Barry does well in the Masters in January, as he more than deserves his place. But as we know, good guys don't always win. Well, the thing about that, of course, is he's playing Judd in the first round. Judd Trump against Barry Hawkins came out the hat, or the two hats. Yeah, humility is a good word. I mean, Barry, the thing with Barry is, you hear about people complaining about what table they're on. He never does that. He doesn't complain what time he's on. He doesn't complain really about anything. He just turns up. He's a popular player. I did say on the commentary on Sunday night, if he'd actually won, within minutes, half the tour, probably more, would have messaged him, congratulating him, and it would have been genuine. We've heard the argument already, but maybe that's what holds him back. I don't know, but I think it was nice to see him have that big moment in the final. Obviously, he wanted to win, but it was nice to see him actually, you know, get back in the 16, because he is, you know, a great sort of stalwart of the tour, isn't he? Now, Owen, I said I'd never mention the Triple Crown again, but I can only respond to what the audience writes about. So he says here, hope you're well and enjoying the UK Championship. This was written during the event. He says, not the highest quality tournament, but so many fascinating matches nonetheless. Just on the quality there, people have said that, and I think it's true, but I think it's true of most tournaments. You know, we're going to build up the Masters, of course, in January, but frankly, you know, half the matches there probably won't be particularly good, because that's true of most tournaments, it's true of most sporting events, really. You can't expect the guys to produce excellence all the time. So there were some low quality matches, but there's some really good ones as well, I think. Anyway, he says, I'm writing this before the final, so Judd might improve his record in the infamous Triple Crown, but I think it's time for a serious chat about using this as a sole measurement for winning big events. I think it's lazy, outdated and disrespectful to criticise Judd's big event record by saying he hasn't got enough Triple Crown titles. Firstly, since the 18-19 season, when Trump became a real top player, only O'Sullivan has won more Triple Crown titles than Judd. So this either tells you that his record isn't that bad, or that it's not an accurate measurement anymore, as other top players haven't won as many. I suppose you could argue that he won his first in 2011 and didn't push on straight away. But even if you think he should have won more Triple Crowns, what does that really prove in this era? I believe that the main reason people use them as a measure is because it's the only real way you can compare the top players from previous eras. But that's just not an accurate barometer in today's game. For example, remember that it was pretty widely acknowledged that there were other events bigger than the UK for the majority of the time Judd's been on the top of, at the top of the game before the format change. Also consider a lot of people think the concept of the Triple Crown is a bit of a farce, but everyone seems to forget about that when it comes to Judd. Secondly, Judd's record in big events is actually very good when you actually count all of the big events. Since 2019, I make it 9 title wins with the prize, first prize of 150,000 plus, with 5 of those being 200,000 plus. This isn't even including events like the Turkish Masters and the 2 World Grand Prix. Let's be honest, between players, big events are the ones that offer big money, and that is actually a very impressive record across a period of less than 6 years. Apologies for the long email, but also not sorry, as I felt like this needed saying. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. Take care and enjoy the shootout. Well, I think I've probably given my thoughts on this. I can't really be more praiseworthy of Judd Trump and his achievements. I think the one valid point to make, and people do make it, is these events, since 1977, these 3 events have always been on the calendar, so you can actually look back at who won them each year. The problem with that is, though, the circuit has changed so much through that period. And also, I mean, Steve Davis said in the 1980s, Steve Davis, he won the Masters 3 times, although the 3rd of them was in the late 90s, 1997. But he said, he was asked, you know, why haven't you done better in the Masters? And he said, well, I think probably I don't try as hard in that tournament because there are no ranking points available. In that period, when the circuit was starting to be built up, the ranking events were considered the major events. Obviously, the World Championship has always been out in front. But the big events like the British Open, which for a couple of years had, you know, first prize second only to the World Championship, you know, the Grand Prix, the Mercantile Classic, the International, those sort of events were considered major tournaments. Obviously, a lot of them have fallen away now. So it's understandable in a way that people look at the other 3 because they've always been there or they've been there nearly 50 years and say that's the kind of standard by which you should be measured. But it just kind of isn't true. But I like I say, I've kind of said far too much on this. You know, it's here to stay. Good luck to it and all the rest. But, you know, there is such a thing. I know it's unfashionable in this day and age, but there is such a thing as historical fact, if anyone is still interested in that. Matt Wilson says this. Apologies in advance for the length of this email. Feel free to pick and choose what you'd like to share, if anything at all. Well, I'll just read it all, Matt. It's easier. He says, thanks for the great podcast. It's a weekly highlight on my long drives to and from work. Firstly, I'm thrilled the BBC snooker coverage has brought back the original drag racer theme. It takes me back to when I fell in love with the sport in the late 80s. However, I was gutted to see the new title visuals replace the ones from 2021, which hold a special place for me. I was lucky enough to feature in those titles after a friend at IMG, at that point produced the BBC snooker coverage, invited me to help film them at Jimmy White's old club in Tooting. Seeing them debut during the UK Championship was an unforgettable moment, so it's bittersweet they've now been replaced. Speaking of snooker connections, you've had some fun emails recently about snooker-themed names. Now, this is a feature that frankly needs a bit more heat under it, but it's people whose names, are connected to snooker, let's put it that way. Anyway, Matt continues, my friend Sonny O'Sullivan, who was also in the aforementioned titles, is a talented player from Aylesbury. When I first met him as a child, I couldn't resist nicknaming him the Socket, a nod to the Rocket Ronnie O'Sullivan. How about that Sonny O'Sullivan? We're now into the slightly different category, which is people's names who sound a little bit like a snooker player. You know, so let's say, you know, your name's, Vinnie White. That's sort of sound slightly like Jimmy White. There's better ones than that. But if you know anyone whose name is slightly like a snooker player, Steve David or something, again, it could use a little heat. Matt continues. I also really appreciated your advice on commentary. I dabbled briefly last year, commentating on the 900 qualifiers at the Crucible Club in Reading. Found it incredibly rewarding. I love engaging with viewers and bringing matches to life, and I often catch myself commentating at home, much to my wife's amusement. I'd love to do more commentary, whether for amateur or professional events, and your insights into making that a reality have been hugely helpful. On commentary and player personalities, I've enjoyed the debates around current players doing punditry during tournaments, and whether today's players lack the charisma of the 70s and 80s legends. Back then, exhibitions were a key income source, so players had to showcase their personalities to secure future work, whether in exhibitions or commentary. Today's players depend more on prize money, but as Sean Murphy demonstrates, showing character on and off the table can still help build a post-play career. Those like Joe Perry and the impressive Stephen Haworth are already paving the way, and it's a strategy more players might consider as they approach retirement. Finally, I'm also enjoying seeing Murphy's demonstrative celebrations more regularly. I wish snooker players would celebrate more often, be it acknowledging the crowd or making a century or stealing an important frame with a granite clearance. I know it's not the snooker way and doesn't conform with the unwritten rules of snooker etiquette, but it's great to see from a viewer's perspective and certainly adds something to the story unfolding on the table. Keep up the great work, always a terrific listen, and by far and away the number one snooker podcast. Well, thank you, Matt. Very kind there. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with celebrations, again, context is everything. You know, if you make a break of 40 in frame one and punch the air, you look ridiculous. But if you go, you know, 4-3 up pot in the black and you punch the air, well, good luck to you, you know. So I think it's about context for sure. Collins writes this. Most of my writings this week are themed around China for no real reason, though it just happens to be. I feel there have been a couple of full storms since Ding emerged, and it's taken maybe a bit longer than everyone thought for players from China to break through. I think we can safely say that this has now happened. 7 of the top 32 are from China, 8 of the last 32 in the UK champs are from China, and indeed 3 out of the top 5 performers in the Snooker Club Fantasy 5 thingy are from China. I'm really pleased that this has happened now, as it's throwing up some really interesting matches and exciting play. When I'm going through the draws pre-tournament, it's normally the Chinese lads that are catching the eye these days. An example was the last 32 tie at York between Xi Jiawei and Wu Yizhe. Okay, it was no good, but that's not the point. These are the players that we look forward to watching, and they bring something different to our screens. Just on that, Colin, I mean, the match wasn't really any good, which was a shame, because it had every right to be, but it wasn't the only one, was it, that week that didn't really deliver? He continues, when watching the events based in China, I've often found myself scratching my head at the fact that the Chinese referees are calling the match in English. I'm wondering why. Yes, of course, the large British influence and involvement. From a player's viewpoint, non-Chinese players won't speak Chinese and more Chinese players will speak some English. However, although a large and thankfully growing number of viewers are tuning into Eurosport, I would have thought that this number must be hugely exceeded by the number of Chinese residents watching via Chinese TV channels who are tuning in to a referee scoring and announcing in English. I don't watch tennis these days, but guessing the umpire at the French Open is scoring in French. Maybe I'm missing something obvious. I don't know, actually, if it's a good point about the French Open. Well, I don't know whether they do it in French. I mean, it may just be that, you know, kind of English has been accepted as the sort of the international language of the sport. He continues here, on a related theme, I'm pretty certain that at the start of the UK Champs match last week between Ding and Robert Milkins, I heard Desyaslava Boshilova offering Ding the coin toss, speaking in Chinese. Top marks for the effort, if so. Finally, I mentioned above that 3 of the top 5 performers in the WST Fantasy 5 are from China, Zhao Guodong, Xi Jiawei and Long Zhihang. Maybe strange that this initiative is rarely mentioned among the snooker diehards on this podcast, and assuming most entered, the recent update email from WST showed that I'm in what appears to be a lowly 1,102nd place, although what appears to be missing is how many entries there were, hopefully more than that. So I was wondering what your position is, and indeed that of our fellow listeners. Maybe for next week or two, when sending in the usual emails, each could be signed off with the position in brackets, e.g. next email is from Colin, 1,102, or Kelly, 384. Looking forward to attending the Scottish Open next week in my home city. For other listeners, Edinburgh is always a nice place to visit at Christmas time, so I look forward to seeing others there. On the fantasy thing, the problem with that is you don't know where you are until they send you the email, because unusually for a fantasy sport thing, you can't actually, there's no website you can go on and see where you are, which to me kind of is what you need to do, because if you say you're playing alongside your friends, you want to see where you are in relation to them. You wait for the email, which comes, I don't know how often it is it every month or every few weeks? And the last one I got, I think I was 600 and something. I don't know for sure. I can't remember, to be honest. I can't find the email now. So, you know, I mean, I had Judd Trump in my fantasy team, but I guess most people did. But yeah, I don't know where I am now, because I have to wait for them to tell me, I suppose. Now, Nick Davis, he says here, I love the podcast, which I regularly listen to, as well as other snooker podcasts. Keep up the good work. With regard to your feature on snooker names, I'm surprised you've not had more responses, and I'm emailing to hopefully fill the gaps. These are obvious and perhaps mundane, but as you regularly say, none the worse for that. The ball colours have many snooker surnames. Jimmy and Michael White, Jordan, Wayne, Oliver and Paddy Brown. Paddy Brown, of course, with an E. Gerald Green, also with an E. Ian Black. Also pool legend Gareth Potts. Extending the feature to just famous people with snooker names leads to Ed Balls, Lily the Pink, skier Spider Savage, and of course your esteemed colleague Angles McManus. Yes, I mean, I think, Alan's name is Alan, of course. But anyway, but you crowbar that in, and why not? And we have another one here from Lucas. He says, you asked if there are any players whose names have anything to do with snooker terms. I can recommend Q-Tracker for this. If you type a word into the search box at the top right, every player containing that word is displayed. I found the following former players after a search. So this is Lucas has brought us here, snooker players who actually themselves have a connection to snooker in their name. Okay, so we had Edward Chalk, who played in a pre-qualifying round of the 1933 English Amateur Championship. Adam Chalkley, who played against Elliot Slesser and Ashley Carty in the 2015 Q School events. Multiple players called Potter, for example, current amateur Luke Potter. Lisa Robilliard, who played in the 2004 Guernsey Amateur Championship. Now that sounds like a vibrant event. The Guernsey Amateur Championship. Michael Cushion, who last played on Q-Tracker in the 2013 English Amateur Championship. Tony Pocket, who played in the 1972 British Under-19 Championship, although his name is spelled with two T's. Anthony Bridge, whose last match on Q-Tracker is a match against Dave Gilbert in 2002. And Helmut Miss. In his only game on Q-Tracker, he lost 4-0, so he probably missed a lot of balls. One in the eye for Helmut Miss there. It says, as I'm writing this, Barry Hawkins is up 61-38 in the first frame against Mark Allen. Although I think it's unlikely, I hope Barry has won his first Triple Crown event by the time you upload your next podcast. Well, sadly he didn't, but anyway, thank you for all of that. I've noticed I've gone past the arbitrary 45-minute limit that I set and basically not kept to. But anyway, we'll continue. Ray says, listening to last week's podcast, I feel I need to comment on something you said about calling out the foul Ronnie committed when he hit the red ball when removing the rest off the table. He may not have seen it, but it's humanly impossible that he didn't feel it. A big up to you for having the integrity to call it out. I remember you also called out the foul made by Karen Wilson when playing with the Spider against Mark Williams in the Masters. That wasn't called a foul by anyone either. The video below, okay, so he sent a video here, is the height of embarrassment and does the sport no good whatsoever. The irony will not be lost on you that it was Mark Allen, knowing what he said before and was fined for. Seems he's been hoisted by his own petard. The truth is the truth, only lies are made up. It's a myth that players always call foul on themselves. Some do sometimes and not other times. We must remember why the foul and rule miss was brought in, because players were trying to get as close to the ball without leaving it on, instead of trying to hit it. Gamesmanship at its worst. Ray sent... Yeah, well, this is actually quite a strange thing, because it was a foul that in the Scottish Open, which was sort of retrospectively not awarded by the referee, but called when they went to look at the video footage, which, of course, in itself is controversial because there's no clear guidelines on whether they can do that or not. It was sort of a VAR moment. Mark Allen feathered the cue ball. Now, there are fouls, actually, where players would not necessarily always know they've fouled. If you speak to players, they will tell you that. But the fact is you can't always know whether they do or not. It's naive, I think, to think that every player on the circuit and indeed throughout snooker history would always call a foul on themselves. It's very naive, clearly. But I think in general, the sport is, in that sense, very clean, and players do. We've had players calling fouls on themselves when they haven't fouled, which is quite extraordinary because, of course, there's so many cameras on them. They kind of know that if they don't do it, you know, people are going to see. All I'll say is, in the case of that match, I mean, it was very slight feathering of the white. And he's playing it off the cushion, so it's entirely possible he didn't feel it. But I have no knowledge either way on whether he did or not. I just don't. Now, of course, Terry Griffiths passed away on Sunday, and, you know, very sad, and I recorded a podcast on Monday looking back at Terry's career and hopefully celebrating him and his life and contribution to snooker, which was considerable. And we've had a fair amount of correspondence on this. Gary Park says, it was terrible to hear about the passing of Terry, such a fundamental part of the game's golden years during its first decade at the Crucible. This was particularly sobering coming in such short succession after Clive Everton, Ray Reardon and Mark Warman all died so recently. I was 11 when Terry won at Sheffield, so these men were so much part of my earliest and fondest memories of televised snooker. Reading Terry's obituaries, one detail that really jumped out for me was his match against Mark Warman that finished at 3:51. I cannot imagine that happening now, and wanted to ask you how it was possible even then in 1983. Surely it cannot be purely a case of several frames taking a very long time. Were there other factors involved? I hope you might be able to shed a bit more light on the matter. Thanks as always for a superb podcast. Long may it continue. Well, thank you, Gary. Well, yeah, it was against Cliff Thorburn, the 3:51. That was the second round of the World Championship. I think he beat Mark in the first round. But Cliff Thorburn was the opponent. They didn't start at the allotted hour, which back then was 7:30. I think it was after 9 o'clock because there was a match still on, and in those days they kind of just carried on. So, but even then, I mean, say they started at 9 o'clock, that's still a hell of a long night to get to nearly 4 in the morning, 3:51 a.m. I mean, look, they were hard players, you know, and I think Cliff was a long way in front and Terry fought back, and, you know, it's a big match and he just got bogged down, I guess. I didn't see it. Clive was there at the end. You know, he stuck it out to the end. Colin Johnson's written back in. He said, having watched snooker since the early 80s, I was always rooting for Terry when he played. I just remember him being involved in so many close matches down to the deciding frame. Some he won, and on those he didn't, I always felt disappointed for him, as he seemed such a nice chap. Not forgetting, of course, his contribution to Snooker Loopy. Hair brushes for my barnet, sung in that very Welsh accent. Thank you, Terry. We go back to Callum Law. Read half of his email earlier, but he says here, it was a great shame that at the end of such an enjoyable tournament, we learned of the passing of another of snooker's great names, Terry Griffiths. His life story and playing career was remarkable. Aside from his tournament victories, something I found amazing was that after the 1996 World Championship, he didn't play in any tournament the following season, other than the qualifiers for the World Championship, got through and then pushed Mark Williams all the way, losing 10-9 at the Crucible. There's some footage of that match on MJT Snooker's YouTube channel, including a great interview at the end with Terry and Mark. Something I found really interesting about Terry as a result of reading Clive's book, Black Farce and Cue Ball Wizards, was how involved he became in snooker's off-table politics and how hard he worked to try to unite the various warring factions and move the game forward. It also seemed apparent in the book that Clive and Terry had a very good relationship. Hopefully they're up there somewhere watching over snooker, as they did for many years in the commentary box of various tournaments. R.I.P. Terry, a pure snooker man. Your place in the pantheon of greats is assured. Well, that's very true, Callum. And, I mean, Terry would always be involved in snooker, I think. And he wanted what was best for the game, clearly. And, you know, as I made the point in the last podcast, he wanted to help people. Brian McGovern, sad to hear the passing of Terry Griffiths. I have one memory that I could be wrong on this. He played Steve Davis in the 1988 World Final. If I'm not mistaken, the Crucible set had globes up behind where the players sat. And if I'm not mistaken, Terry accidentally knocked it off. Well, he did, Brian. I mean, and it was presented to him at the end. There's a picture of him holding the globe. He knocked it off its moorings, if that's the word. They sort of, I don't know what he did with it, whether he took it home with him, but he was given it at the end as a kind of, you know, as a kind of recognition of that. It was quite funny, I suppose. Kelly Barker. Hello, Kelly. I met Kelly and Chris Downer in a pub in York. But anyway, that's a separate issue. I've just listened to your lovely tribute episode to Terry Griffiths. Another sad day in what's been a sad year for snooker, especially Welsh snooker. No one ever had a bad word to say about Terry, which speaks volumes about the man he was. And he was snooker through and through, be it playing, coaching or commentating. One of the toughest competitors of all time, but always had a smile, and he'll be so greatly missed. Condolences to all his family and loved ones. Meanwhile, congratulations to Judd Trump on winning his second UK title in what is becoming another amazing season. His all-round game has taken him to new levels and can only see more titles going his way with his winning formula. Best in the world, and he's proving it time again. Thank you, Kelly. Like Kelly, Tommy O'Pray has written in about Terry Griffiths. I was touched by your beautiful words yesterday on the passing of the great Terry Griffiths. You spoke from the heart and it really came across. The line about Terry's condition preventing him recalling his many achievements really saddened me. Your tributes to Clive Everton and Ray Reardon were equally touching. As a part-time funeral celebrant, I know how hard it can be to not only write a tribute for a friend, but to share it out loud. I've had this honour too many times. As I quietly listened to your words, I wondered if any other sport held their heroes in such high regard. Obviously, fans of every sport share posts on social media when a star of their own sport dies, but in snooker it feels different. Now, perhaps this is just my perception, but when I look at some of the greats of the game, they almost feel like family and their loss is real. It may be that because there are no teams in snooker, we recognise every player's talents individually and brilliance, or that because the tour is relatively small, we feel we know many of the players more than we actually do. Anyway, I just wanted to thank you for sharing your words and memories of these wonderful characters. I'm sure they will all be spoken of for many years to come. Well, thank you, Tommy. I've just noticed you said there's no need to read this email out, but I have read it out. But anyway, thank you for sending it in. Thank you for taking the time. And yeah, I mean, I think sport in general, I mean, football is all about sentiment, really. Sport does summon these feelings because for so many people, sport is actually an outlet away from real life concerns. You know, if your job's getting you down or you've got problems at home, you know, the 2 hours you spend at a football match on a Saturday can take you out of that. And of course, it's also very much a link to family. So often we start in sport through our parents or through family. And that sport and the characters in that sport are a reminder of those family members that maybe are no longer with us. So if you started watching snooker with a grandparent, you know, you might have watched Terry Griffiths playing with a grandparent years ago. I'm sure this week when you heard he passed away, you thought of them as well. And I think snooker, like a lot of other sports, definitely sort of has that quality to it. There's a kind of thread, if you're a long-time fan, running through your whole life. And sport is not some ephemeral distraction. You know, it is actually central to our culture. It's one of the few things that actually brings people together. It can divide people as well, but a national sporting event can bring people together. And there's a lot to be said for that. There's a lot to be said for the joy that people take from sport. And of course, these people who play it to such a high level, and Terry certainly did that, are a big part of that as well. Now, Tim Peters, I know Tim, he's a commentator. He says, sir, I've just listened to your tribute to Terry Griffiths and wanted to thank you for doing that. Without doubt, one of the most liked on the circuit and a fantastic ambassador. I only met Terry once. It was a very brief meeting, but I still remember it as if it was yesterday. He greeted me like a long-lost friend. I was with our very good mutual friend and colleague, Neil Folds. Terry didn't know me at all, but that was Terry. He made me feel $1 million. He didn't need to, but he did. What a wonderful man. He was at the Wembley Conference Centre, and he was pacing around outside the venue, inside the venue, but outside the auditorium. One of the players he coached at the time was playing, early 2000s. He was pacing around the corridor. He was extremely nervous about the game. He lived and breathed it. He was also a master of one-liners. I remember hearing the story of a late-night match. Actually, the match was still going well into the early hours. Terry turned to the audience that remained and said, "It's not looking so bloody promising, is it?" in that wonderful Welsh brogue. Even then, he was sensing the humour of the situation. He lost the match. Rest in peace, Terry. On a brighter note, I also wanted to pass on a very belated thank you to you for taking 2 well-earned days off a year ago. This allowed me the opportunity to step in to work alongside Neil and Fergal O'Brien on the shootout played in Swansea. And working alongside Fergal, we were treated to that magical 147 from Sean Murphy. About half an hour earlier, we'd been treated to the Lincolnshire Sausage, Stephen Haworth, winning his match. I appreciate that nickname is no more now. I think, just jumping in, I think Stephen didn't want it to be anything then, by the way. But anyway, he says, but that did amuse me at the time. Stephen sizzled. You see what he did there? And won his match by putting in a banger of a performance. We'll continue. He says, I think Stephen might be working with you this week, so that's why I included that. Fergal and I celebrated with the maximum with ham, egg and chips at a nearby cafe after Sean's magical moment. Who says rock and roll is dead? I mentioned this, just jumping in there, Tim, of course, this is why you should, as a freelance, you should never take days off, because you allow other people in. And you got to do, you're quite right, you got to do that terrific moment, which, put it this way, if you got repeat fees, you could retire. I've seen that a lot of times since, and why not? It was a very special moment, wasn't it, the 147 from Sean Murphy. Tim continues, I mentioned this 147 because I witnessed another one in York last week. I was up working in Yorkshire, horse racing, commentating, and managed to link it in with a night with my brother at the snooker. My brother is not a regular snooker attendee, but he was absolutely made up to witness Shangander complete a maximum break. I was supposed to do that one as well, by the way, and the rotor got changed, and I was given the night off, which was welcome, but again, other people did it. He says, we sat higher up in the Barbican and watched that game and the Stuart Bingham comeback win over Mark Williams. It was a great night. We thoroughly enjoyed it. I've been to the Barbican several times over the years and I still love going there. I know York well, so I fully appreciate the charm of the city. We all marvel at the ability of the top players in the game, but Jan Anders' cue ball control is up there with the best. Even when he wasn't having the impact he's enjoyed in the last 15 months, he's always had the ability to score heavily. His calmness under pressure impressed me when making the 147. I've also noticed that he speaks pretty good English. He seems a very relaxed character. I'd like to congratulate Judd and Barry on an absorbing final two great ambassadors for the game and two left-handers. My late granddad was the reason I got into snooker at a young age. He was a left-hander, and so am I, even though I'm right-handed at everything else. That's an extraordinary thing to say, isn't it? So, basically, you play snooker left-handed. I don't know how good Tim is at snooker. If I see him, I'll ask him. But maybe, Tim, if you're no good, you should actually play right-handed. It could be a revelation. He says, the final World Championship he got to watch before his passing in late 2010 was won by, of course, a left-hander, Neil Robertson. And finally, thank you to you for a highly enjoyable podcast. I'm a regular listener, and I enjoy your wit and knowledge of the game. Clive Everton taught you very well. I only met Clive once too, although we chatted on the phone a couple of times when I did a bit of commentary work for him many years ago. Like Terry Griffiths, he also left a very positive imprint on me. It's been a sad year, as we've also lost Ray Reardon and Mark Warman too. They're all great characters and will be very sadly missed. Keep up the excellent work, and I hope you enjoyed the shootout. Who knows, you might even be rewarded with a 147. what you neglected to put there is in brackets, like me, but that's fine. Just on the Barbican, of course, there was talk about it leaving York, but it will be there next year. Tickets have already gone on sale. I think it's a terrific city, clearly. I mean, it was rammed with people, the Christmas markets and everything else, but it's a very popular tourist destination within the UK. Lovely place. The Barbican itself, I heard a few grumbles, not from players actually, but from sort of people working there, a little bit about it's a bit restricted backstage. You know, it's the old Crucible argument again. There could be venues with more room, and I'm sure there could be venues with more capacity, and it's important to maximise, you know, these events. But the fact is, it's now so established there. I think the atmosphere was lovely all week. The crowds were really positive. And, you know, you're sort of in the city centre, so you know, you spill out, there's places to go, pubs and restaurants, whatever, and a lot of real good chat about the snooker all around. So it was a really nice feeling the whole week, and a lot of that comes from just being actually in York itself. Finally, we will end this week with Ben Summers, and this is a pretty extraordinary email to end in. Ben lives in Brighton. Merry Snookmas. I recently carried out my annual Google search for a copy of Stuart Pettman's As Sometimes Seen on TV, but was met with the same fruitless results as in previous years. I wonder if you have any leads. Well, leads is a big word. Ben, not really, but I mean, obviously it was quite a niche publication at the time it came out. I may have a copy somewhere, and if I do, I'll be happy to send it to you, but I don't actually know where it would be. So if anyone listening has a copy of this, it's Stuart Pettman's As Sometimes Seen on TV. If they no longer require it, clearly Ben wants to get his hands on it, and that's fine, you know, why shouldn't he? So if you have got a copy, do write in, and I'll put you in touch, and, you know, it will be the feel-good story of the year. You know, it is Christmas, it's the time miracles happen. So if anybody has a copy, and they would, you know, they can spare it, then, you know, do please get in touch, and, yeah, I'll put you in touch, and it'll all be a lovely thing. So that's it. Now, the shootout is on this week. I think we've moved past the whole, it shouldn't be a ranking event, blah, blah, blah. It is, and that's just a fact. And it is something different. I think coming after the UK Championship actually is a good thing. Had such a kind of serious week there. Maybe this is a chance for people to let their hair down. It's worth saying as well, and it's a good initiative. The WPA have invited a lot of, well, not a lot, I think, but eight sort of youngsters in, you know, from different parts of the UK and the world who, you know, we'll have a chance to play on TV, and that's no small thing. And there might be some names there who we see in future years. It's a great way of continuing to inspire these juniors to actually keep playing snooker. It's a chance, the carrot is there, dangling away to get in an event like this. And that's a good thing. So obviously they're lining up against some real big hitters. Anyway, that's this week. Next week is the Scottish Open. And then there's the Saudi Championship, the Riyadh season event, which now has the field set because it was the top 10 after the UK Championship. So qualifying as well, and then we're done. So the shootout will be on Eurosport and Discovery Plus, and for other broadcasters, do check the World Snooker website. But that's it for this week. So thank you for your, patience. And I think that probably is the word, really, if you've made it this far. They do say the only place you can keep a secret these days is at the end of a long podcast. But anyway, that's it. I will be working on the shootout. Dominic Dell and Stephen Hallworth will be the other commentators alongside myself and Philip Studd. And we've got Jimmy White, Rhiann Evans, Neil Folds with Rachel Casey in the studio. And it's always a lively affair. And what I would say is that, you know, if you don't like it, you don't like it. You also don't have to watch it. The worst people are the ones that say they don't like it, but still watch it. There's other things you can be doing, frankly. You could be listening to this podcast, maybe. I shall enjoy it, and I shall be back next week, hopefully. So that's it for this week. You can contact us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. We're members of the Sports Social Network. They have other podcasts as well. But that's it. So as we always say, thanks for listening. And it is, of course, goodbye-bye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.